Hello, this is Ross Bliley from the podcast Pigskin Tales. This podcast is sponsored by Sterling Soap Company. With products sold throughout 41 locations around the globe, Sterling Soap Company has a unique assortment of products to choose from for your loved one for the holidays. Handmade artisan soaps created by Roderick and Amanda Loven since 2012, these products are affordable and provide great value. Act now and save on your shipping costs. If you purchase $75 or more, your shipping cost is free in the United States. Shop now online at sterlingsoap.com.
And we're pleased to have another episode of the Professional Football Researchers Association podcast, the official PFRA podcast as part of the Sports History Network. So on our last episode, we had on the former Charger, Ron Mix. If you want to go back and listen to that, you can, as part of the Sports History Network. And then we have another episode coming up now, as we're very, very excited for that. And we bring in our guest here this evening, and that is Bert Gambini. He is a member of the Professional Football Researchers Association, and he works at the University of Buffalo in the communications department as part of their news content management. Bert, thanks for joining us.
John and George, it is a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, it's great to have you on, and it's great to talk about this topic with you. I think that there's a lot of people that know the origins of the term gridiron football, and they have a certain date in mind. They have a certain thought process of how we originated the game that has eventually evolved into 11 players against 11 players. And Bert, you've done some research in the last couple years that maybe proves what was thought to be standard knowledge for so many years to not actually be factually correct. And that's why we wanted to have you on, to tell maybe the new story of when gridiron football actually began.
Well, the story that we're often told, the conventional history, is one that goes back to November of 1869, and that was a match that was involving Princeton and Rutgers. If you go to any library with a good football collection, you're not going to have a hard time finding 10, 15, maybe even 20 references to that fact. But the great curiosity is that all of those references are qualified, and they're qualified in a manner that says Princeton and Rutgers was the first football game, but not really. And the historical reality becomes problematic because Princeton and Rutgers played a soccer game. And there's nothing that is groundbreaking about making that conclusion. Reading the rules, you clearly see an early form of soccer. U.S. soccer, the governing body of soccer in the United States, recognizes Princeton-Rutgers as the first soccer game, the first intercollegiate soccer game in America. So how can that game be both the first football game and the first soccer game? And that's what launched me on this research. And there have been competing claims, too. There are some researchers and some writers and some commentators who push that timeline forward a little bit, and they look at games in the 1870s. Those are more rugby games. I come to one that I don't think has been mentioned previously, but it's one that I am pretty confident does in fact represent the very first football game that was played intercollegiately. That is football's beginning. That beginning happened on October 16th, 1880. And it did involve Rutgers, but the opponent in this case was the Stevens Institute, a team and a university that we don't really associate with a grand football tradition. But Stevens was actually one of the first intercollegiate football teams in the country. They helped build the programs that we have today and the intercollegiate football we have today. They dropped their program in the 1920s, but they were one of the first to adopt football and play it for several years.
You know, something that I find really interesting about this, Bert, is how you figure out the I guess the actual record of these things taking place. I know that at that point there were, I'm sure, yearbooks that existed at different collegiate universities, and I'm sure there were some newspaper markings. But if a football game happens now, there's 800 people tweeting about it, and there's another 6 million watching at home, maybe 2.4 billion. So when this is something that you have to pinpoint in 1880, in times where there was no social media, there was limited newspaper coverage, there was limited media coverage as a whole, how do you find this and pick this out of that big realm that could have happened in that time?
Well, John, it's interesting because this game in particular, and everything you said about that coverage is accurate, but this game was well covered. And as to why the game drew so much attention had, I think, a lot to do with the rule changes that happened a few days earlier. It was in October when the Intercollegiate Football Association, which would be the precursor to what would become the NCAA, they met to revise the rules of football. Now, keep in mind, when every time I say football, I'm speaking generically, and I'm going to try and clarify whether I'm talking about a soccer game, a rugby game, or a gridiron football game. Because when the Rules Committee met in 1880, for the most part, all the schools involved in football programs were playing rugby, or at least an American version of rugby that Harvard had introduced a few years earlier. The Rules Committee in 1880 did two things. The first is, there were some seven rule changes, but the two that I want to concentrate on for the moment were a reduction in the number of players. They took the standard rugby 15 and they whittled that down to 11 players. The more significant change was the creation of scrimmage. And that is the linchpin for my definition of football and my definition for what accounts for the first game. That football is scrimmage and scrimmage is football. And I'm saying, you know, my definition and my interpretation. I really should retreat from that a little bit because when I presented some of this research at the Buffalo chapter meeting of PFRA toward the end of April, I mentioned that the piece was reverse engineered. Now, I had talked about it's very easy to find references to Princeton Rutgers being the first football game, qualified references. It's even easier to find references to football beginning with scrimmage. And originally, the piece that I had written, which is coming up in an issue of Coffin Corner, the official magazine of our organization, I was going to publish two appendices, one that listed all of those writers and all of those sources who mentioned Princeton Rutgers 1869, but qualify that. And then I was going to have a similar appendix that mentioned all the sources that count for scrimmage. Space considerations made that impossible. In fact, I think I stopped at some 25 or 26 references. So the Rutgers-Stevens game was in fact well covered. I have at least four sources that point to it. All of those sources say it was the first game played in the 1880 season under the new rules. And that's basically what I did. I reverse engineered the piece. I said, all right, if all of these commentators and all of these historians and all of these researchers are saying that football began with scrimmage, then let's just find the first football game that featured that instrument. And I'd love to tell the two of you that it involved this backbreaking research and going through dusty archives and finding a trunk. But the fact is, John, that this game was well covered. The New York Times covered it. The New York Sun covered it. The New York Tribune covered it. And the New York Herald covered it. And fortunately, they did. They covered it in the style of 19th century sports writing, but they covered it, and we have those sources that can point to this game.
And even with that being the first game that actually had scrimmage, I think it's interesting because in the article and I think in the discussion in Buffalo that John and I both attended, you said that it was still evolving, that, you know, we really hadn't started having downs that sometimes teams had the ball for, you know, like a whole half.
I mean, you know, scrimmage wasn't perfect, George. You know, I think, you know, every age carries with it the seeds of its own destruction. And scrimmage nearly destroyed football. You know, the very thing that gave rise to the game that we talk about today, a game that is enjoyed by millions, was nearly destroyed by the instrument of scrimmage. And I'm going to tell you how. Scrimmage took away the random fluid nature of rugby and leaned more toward a scientific and better managed game by awarding one side possession. One side has undisputed possession of the ball. What the rules committee didn't do is devise a manner for surrendering possession. Remember, there are no downs and yards to go at this point. And it was thought that sportsmanship would dictate that if a team was unable to move the ball, they would simply hand it to their opponent. And that didn't happen. What resulted was what we call the block game. And if a team did not score or fumble, they could maintain possession for an entire half. And sometimes they did that with intentional retreats just to maintain possession. The game was deadly boring. It was impossible to watch. It was so dreary. A couple of years later, the system of downs and yards to go were instituted. And there are some historians who say downs and yards to go should represent the beginning of football. But in the piece, I make a point of distinguishing between the evolution of a game and the revolutions that changed a game. And this is something that I adapted from Melvin I. Smith, who was a meteorologist who did painstaking research to chronicle games from the late 19th century. Mel Smith talked about the kicking game, soccer, the carrying game of rugby, and the possession game of football. I think history has conflated those three games into a linear evolution in the sense that rugby emerged from soccer and gridiron football emerged from rugby. That is not the case. These were seen as three distinctive games, and there were three revolutions that came to give us the modern form of football. The first of which was two intercollegiate teams meeting for what was the first soccer game. This brings two intercollegiate squads together in Princeton and Rutgers. The second revolution was adopting the rugby code in 1876. The third revolution was scrimmage. And what I reason in the piece is that any significant rule change that happened between those revolutionary signposts represents an evolution of the game. The only reason we have downs and yards to go is because we have scrimmage. And I can say the same for the passing game. Some observers say the forward pass should mark the beginning of scrimmage. Should mark the beginning of football. The forward pass, again, emerged from the invention of scrimmage. We wouldn't have passing if there was no scrimmage. We wouldn't have downs and yards to go. Scrimmage was not perfect, but it put us on a road to a much better game. And we've been tinkering with the game forever. We're like obsessive mechanics. We're always trying to get it to be safer and run better. And that's what every little tweak has been geared for or geared toward through the years. It's either been to improve the game, make it more enjoyable, or to make the game safer. And that's what we have, is that I think that if we're going to talk about these games, we have to segment them. There is soccer, there is rugby, and there is football. We went from one to the other because of revolutions.
University of Buffalo Communications News Content Manager Bert Gambini, our guest here on the official Professional Football Researchers Association podcast, talking about the origins of the game of football and maybe better yet to that, gridiron football. Bert, when it comes to how you hope to present this moving forward, I know, as you said, you've got an article in Coffin Corner. I know you've done a presentation to the PFRA crew in Western New York. Is the hope to write a book? Is the hope to write a thesis? What do you hope to bring to light to the greater public so that maybe they can have an understanding of it just like we are right now?
Well, you know, I still haven't left this period, John, even though the piece is finished. And the more I read about this period in football history, I think when you talk about, like, what could lead from this, I find myself wishing that the historical significance of Rutgers-Stevens would have been realized in the immediate wake of its occurrence. It was Park Davis, former football player, coach, and historian, who really enshrined the Princeton-Rutgers 1869 game as the very first to ever be played. And he wrote a book called Football, the American Intercollegiate Game, which became an early 20th century classic of sport. He relied on testimony from surviving players in that book. And although it doesn't represent the first football game, we still have what I see as a historically valuable document. But I wish we could have done that with the Rutgers and Stevens players. What would they think, looking back, about the shape of their game? You know, the NFL was founded in 1920, 40 years removed from Rutgers-Stevens. What did these players think? And the quarterbacks in particular. We haven't talked about that. But the invention of scrimmage created the position of quarterback. And although we sometimes identified players as quarterbacks, borrowing terms from rugby, the football quarterback didn't exist until scrimmage was introduced in 1880. The players on Rutgers and Stevens, they were the first ever to play that position. Wouldn't you love how they were chosen, Theodore DeWitt and John Pracy? Pracy for Stevens and DeWitt for Rutgers. You know, did they long for the liberties that were granted quarterbacks, which when they played were in the rules that just denied them of those liberties?
Do you believe?
Again, I'm thinking about.
I was going to say, Bert, do you believe, though, that there are any, like, descendants from that game that would have, I don't know, family stories, family heirlooms that could be able to help further identify elements from the story? Like, DeWitt, could his great-great-grandson maybe have an artifact from that game that could help, you know, shed some light into what that experience was like? Do you think that exists?
I think the possibility certainly exists. You know, we're always rescuing things from oblivion when we're writing history. We're always trying to find those elements that'll help us tell a better story. It's possible, John, that because the historical significance of Rutgers-Stevens isn't known, that people in possession of those items might not be aware that they can enrich the story. I'd like to think that they're out there. Finding them would be exactly as you said. You know, can we find descendants of DeWitt and Pracy? I think it would be great to uncover something like that.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that you say that because, you know, watching like a show like Antiques Roadshow on PBS, you know, people come in with something and they say, oh, you know, this was in my garage and I didn't know what it was and didn't know what the value was. And you know, I guess that's a fascinating part of history, as you said, is those things that maybe are, you know, collecting dust somewhere in somebody's garage and they don't know what they have. And, you know, and then, you know, it comes to light.
Yeah. And remember that these players didn't know what they were doing either.
Yeah.
You know, these were a bunch of undergraduates involved in, a distraction from their studies. They didn't realize that they were breaking new ground. They didn't realize that they were creating new sport. You know, and going back to the newspaper coverage of the game, I said that it was well covered. The papers, for the most part, missed scrimmage, however. You know, they concentrated on what was obvious, you know, the reduction in the number of players from 15 to 11. You know, even leading up to that game, there was a New York Times piece about the rule changes that referred to, yes, the reduction of players, and then other minor changes to the wording of the rules. Nobody at the time really understood the significance of scrimmage. And we should also remember, too, that scrimmage, which replaced the rugby scrum, the two of them really looked a lot alike. So the casual observer may have missed the difference between the two. I did find some fleeting references to the introduction of scrimmage, one being, you know, a reflection of the block game, where a team was said to have held possession for some 20 minutes, where the game became, you know, a rather boring affair. You know, later in the season, we have more distinct references to scrimmage, specifically a game involving Yale and Columbia. But, you know, it's not only a matter of rescuing these items from oblivion. You know, these players didn't know that they were doing anything historic. And even in the decades followed, this game has just not been recognized as the significant occurrence that it is or that it was.
You know, one thing I don't think we mentioned is the score of the game was actually Rutgers won 1-0. Can you tell us anything about the scoring?
Yeah, scoring changed. At the time, touchdowns didn't count. You know, if you did score or a touchdown or a goal, it gave you the opportunity to kick. You know, football scoring went through a lot of changes. Remember, we're also playing without end zones at this time, only goal lines. You know, and not just the scoring. You know, football as a game doesn't become, I think, recognizable to a modern observer probably until we get into the early 20th century. Scrimmage is the backbone on which football was built. It's the, you know, it is the genetic marker for football. But it took a while for the game to take what we would call a recognizable shape.
Bert, just generally, what drew you to this topic and to research this?
You know, the first three books, among the first three books that I ever owned, football books, that is, they were all historical in nature. One was given to me by my mother and the other two, one each by an aunt. And I think those books in large part created an interest in football history that's almost as old as my interest in football itself. And looking through those books, for me, as somebody coming up in the 1970s as a football fan, to look back 50 years was to see a game that was much different than what I was watching on television. Red Grange looked nothing like Joe Namath. And I think that intrigued me, like, to learn. And I was, you know, in grade school at this time. You know, I know more about the... And the were very valuable. One was the Encyclopedic History of Professional Football. I think it was the second edition. One was the Scrapbook History of Pro Football, which was a collection of reproduced newspaper articles. And the third was a history of the Super Bowl, more contemporary than the other two that I mentioned, that chronicled only the first five Super Bowls. But that in itself was also, I think, valuable because it captured Super Bowl V, the first Super Bowl played after the merger was complete, and was able to juxtapose that game against the four earlier games when we were still in the structure of separate leagues. Remember, the merger had been announced by the time we played the first Super Bowl, but the merger progressed sequentially and wasn't complete until the amalgamation of the two leagues into two separate conferences and Super Bowl V, which is incidentally how we ended up with two NFL teams in Super Bowl V, or at least two teams that the year before were playing in the National Football League and didn't have a representative of the old AFL in Super Bowl V.
Bert, last thing for you here. I want to give people the opportunity to be able to have this discussion with you if they want to. Where can people find you? Where can people communicate with you? I know you're on some social medias, but there is not a book. There isn't a written piece about it, obviously, in the Coffin Corner. But tell people where they can find you and how they could call you and maybe have this discussion with you if somebody wants to go further down the rabbit hole with you of having this discussion.
You can find me on Facebook. I have a Facebook page. My email address is just my name at gmail.com, BertGambini@gmail.com. If you have anything that, you think could contribute to, I think I had mentioned I'm still reading about this and finding it hard to leave the 19th century. You can get in touch with me that way. I'd love to hear from people and hear their thoughts.
I'm just surprised that you think that Red Grange and Joe Namath were not similar in any way. I look at the two and I'm like, carbon copy, right?
But, we wouldn't be talking about Joe Namath if we didn't have DeWitt and Precy. And, before we leave, there's something that I found reading the rule book from 1880 against the rule book from 1882. I'd like to leave you with this thought because I think it's important as we look at the historical significance of this game. Although DeWitt and Precy were identified as quarterbacks, and this was rather common in these 19th century stories where the roster would be printed right within the body of the story itself. We still hadn't come up with this idea of having one person play quarterback. It was often a rotation. And the same was true for center, or what we used to call the snapback. So although DeWitt and Precy were identified as quarterbacks, they didn't necessarily take every snap. That began to change. And it's interesting because this is what I came across when I'm looking at the 1880 rule book. The man who receives the ball from the snapback shall be called the quarterback. Now, snapback or center is mentioned dismissively, but the quarterback in that language is practically ordained. Shall be called. It sounds like something out of King Arthur, doesn't it? Like who shall pull forth the sword from the anvil, or who shall be our king? And that might sound exaggerated, but go back to Seth Wickersham's book, brilliant book from last year, which was a biography of the quarterback. It was titled American Kings. And that's the distinctive feature that I want to leave you with. Now, remember, guys, I'm not saying that the 1880 rule book is Virgil or some other revered piece of great literature, but it was written by kids who could probably quote Virgil or some other piece of revered literature. These were students who were attending elite universities when the liberal arts education reigned supreme, and they were transforming their game. The question is, were they hinting at that in the language? Well, now consider this from 1882, as the question becomes more intriguing. The language in the 1882 rule book loses that tone of expectation. And instead it becomes declarative. The man to first receive the ball is the quarterback. So why change it? Why change that language after just 2 years? I think part of the reason, and I found two references to this, one by Walter Camp, who's often regarded as the father of American football, in his book from 1883, that said the quarterback was now one person. In 2 years, we had settled in on the fact that one person is going to be quarterback. The other reference to that was a book called University Football, and it was written by Edgar Allan Poe, who is the nephew of the American writer who might first come to mind when you hear that name. The younger Poe actually played quarterback for Princeton and went on to serve as attorney general in Maryland. So here's the question I'm going to leave you with. Did the language change intentionally or incidentally? I'm not sure I have the answer, but I'm leaning toward intentional. And The reason I do this is because DeWitt and Tracy were identified as the first quarterbacks in that first intercollegiate game. And, you know, Tom Perrin just brings this point home in his book, A History of a College Football, where in the opening sentence, he says that American football began with scrimmage and the quarterback who handled the ball first on every play in 1880. So whenever we tip our hat to a quarterback, I'm a Bills fan, so whenever I tip my hat to Josh Allen, that gesture first acquired its significance thanks to Theodore DeWitt and John Pracy. And I just think it's time that we recognize them, Rutgers and the Stevens Institute, and the game that they began with on October of 1880.
Some NFL franchises have been lucky enough to identify one quarterback as being the correct way. The Cleveland Browns, on the other hand, still have not identified that one quarterback is the correct way to press forward. Bert Gambini, we appreciate your time. Again, from the University of Buffalo, news content manager as part of their communications department. Bert, it's great to have you on the podcast here tonight. George and I enjoyed everything with you, and we look forward to doing this again when you have more research.
All right. Thanks, guys. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
Bert, we appreciate it. Great stuff.
Hey there, sports history fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude. And I hope that you enjoyed this recent episode presented by the Sports History Network and were able to learn some good old-fashioned sports history knowledge nuggets. I started the Sports History Network back in 2020 with the mission to help podcasters find a community of like-minded sports history nerds, as well as helping aspiring podcasters to start their own shows. We have a little bit over 30 shows on the network right now covering all sorts of sports history, but as far as I'm concerned, we're just at the toothpick in the ocean moment, you know, that can't even figure it out because there's so much more coming. We wanted to create the ultimate headquarters for sports yesteryear, starting with Podcast Network and our website, but we're going to continue to move into other mediums as well. And here's the cool part, because we want you to be part of our team. So if you're interested in starting your own podcast, or maybe being a guest on one of our shows, or who knows, maybe even writing an article for us over on the website. Seriously, all you got to do is reach out to us on the contact page over at sportshistorynetwork.com. You can be as technologically savvy as a Neanderthal tapping on a stone trying to figure out this whole hieroglyphics thing back in the day. Again, it doesn't matter, because even if you don't understand the whole podcast space, we have a production team that can pretty much help you out with doing everything. All you gotta do, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com, head to the contact page, fill it out. That message goes right to me, and I'll reach out to you as soon as I can. But for now, dude, I'm through if you're through.